How about we just be real and say that sometimes a lemon is a lemon? Why are we always forcing ourselves to make lemonade out of the lemons? Sometimes it's just a lemon. And let's just talk about the lemon for once.
Welcome to the Resilient People Podcast. My name is Janet Fanacki. I speak with regular, but what I call extraordinary people from around the world who are admired for their resilience. They've overcome a major challenge and turn this difficult experience into something positive, a purpose to help others be resilient too. The challenges of being a stay-at-home parent are real. Yes, there are many rewards, but it's a job that is 24/7 and at times very demanding. For Dale Allen Berg, being a stay-at-home dad to three active young children under the age of six is enough to make anyone crouch down in fear. On top of the regular chores at home, cooking, cleaning, driving for things, appointments, programs, his three children, Liam and twins, Ethan and Madison, all have special needs that require a lot of medical and occupational assistance. In addition, Dale is also living with his own serious health issues. He has said that people call his life a roller coaster, that he's been flung from the most exciting highs to the scariest lows. As a former concert producer and executive chef, these high-pressure jobs may just have prepared him for his life now, but it's still a lot to handle. He shares his daily experiences on a blog, and prior to the pandemic, he spoke to groups to share his life story and lessons learned. I spoke with Dale from his home in beautiful Kelowna, British Columbia.
First question I have for you is, how are you doing and how is life with COVID as opposed to what it was like pre-COVID in your house?
I always try to live life as honestly as possible. And so it's when I get asked that question, like a lot of times people expect that, oh, I'm fine. I'm good. Yeah, no big deal. And you kind of move on. I get that impression from a lot of people. I'm not like that though. I don't give that response. So how am I doing? I'm lonely. I think that's the biggest word that sums up how I've been feeling this year. And it's because the social aspects have been taken away from us, right? You're not allowed to gather. You're not allowed to have people in your home. You're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to do that. Before becoming a stay-at-home parent, I was a concert producer. I was deep into the special events and concert industry. I owned my own company for almost 10 years in producing concerts. And I produced over 500 concerts. This is my passion in life. I love live music. Guess which industry got hit the hardest this year? Live music, events, they're gone, right? And so that sense of community, that sense of the social aspect has all been taken away this year. And so to sum up in one word, how am I doing? I'm very lonely. That's how COVID has hit me. In terms of our household, and I've seen this from a lot of special needs families, is it hasn't changed anything for us. I have three special needs kids. One who's very severe. My daughter Madison has what's called Rett syndrome. And it's completely debilitating. And she's a high risk, high risk of dying if she were to catch something like this. That's always on my mind. But here's the thing. What did I just say? That's always on my mind. It's nothing new this year. Just because COVID hit this year doesn't mean that I'm now all of a sudden aware that my daughter is high risk. She always has been. Even if she caught the cold or the flu last year, she would have been high risk. We know a lot of families who have Rett girls. And last year alone, we knew of seven girls who died last year. And all seven of them was because they had caught the flu or the cold. That was what triggered them going to the hospital and then eventually passing away. So this was last year. This was pre-COVID. So we're very aware of the risks. And so in that regard, nothing's changed.
Let's talk about life with the kids because you're with them so much. What are the challenges that come with being a stay-at-home dad?
Perception would be the biggest challenge. If we're talking about logistics, the day-to-day, if you're the type of personality like I am, if you're built for doing those kind of things, it's no different than a stay-at-home mom, a stay-at-home parent, whatever. I know how to do dishes. I know how to cook. My first job was in a professional kitchen when I was 13 years old. It's the perception of it, though. When I drop my kids off at preschool or at school, I'm surrounded with all the moms. At first, it's changed now, but I had to work a lot to change this. But at first, I got comments like, oh, it's so nice seeing that you're giving mom the day off. And are we going to see mom sometime this week? And and just comments kind of shooting right over my head, almost ignoring that I'm their parent as well. And the expectation was that it was the mom's job. And so that was tough at first, just that perception of I'm doing a woman's job. And that is not it at all. And in my writing on my blog and in my interactions, in my social media, I'm trying to fight that stereotype. It is breaking. It's not everybody, but it does still exist. There are a lot of people out there who see parenting as the mom's job and working, as in bringing home the paycheck, as the man's job. And so that's been probably the biggest struggle.
So you've got Liam and you have the twins, Madison and Ethan. Tell me a little bit about them.
Liam is our oldest. He is 6 years old right now. And he's our miracle child. We tried for 7 years to conceive and it just didn't happen. And so we had almost given up. We set the deadline as being the last day of the year, that year, December 31st. And if we hadn't conceived by then, we were going to go seek medical help. And on Christmas morning, we conceived and Liam showed up 9 months later. Yeah, he's our little Christmas miracle. I know every parent might say this or see this, but he was perfect. He was the perfect child. He slept, he fed, he was so cooperative. Life was great. And then 12 months later, my wife got pregnant again. So just like that, like we've tried for 7 years, nothing, and now two within 9 months, because at 12 months, she lost it. We had a miscarriage at 12 months after. And so we had that little hiccup in there that was quite devastating. And then 20 months after Liam was born, the twins were born. Yeah, a lot in a short period of time.
No kidding. High energy. Wow.
That's more on my wife, right? Like the pregnancies thing. Like I've been reminded by several of my friends. It's like, dads can't claim anything for like going through pregnancy. Like you are not pregnant. Your wife is pregnant and things like that, right? While I can get excited about it and while I can be supportive about it, going through three pregnancies within 2 years, like I have to throw my hands up on that one and pass that off to my wife and say, like, she did that one. So then the twins were born and they were born 6 weeks premature, which isn't that uncommon for twins. And also the age that my wife and I are, we're a bit older according to pediatricians and OBGYNs and that whole sector of pregnancy. And they survived. We were in the NICU for 22 or 23 days, again, as was kind of expected. But then things started to go downhill within the next year. And we started noticing little signs with Madison first. She wasn't hitting all her milestones on time. And I know a lot of parents are very, very strict about that. And they watch the clock and the calendar, like very A-type personality, rigid. They said 3 months. It is 3 months and a week. Why aren't we there yet? And my wife and I are not those kind of people. We're just like, 3 months, 4 months, it'll happen. But 4 months turned into 5 months, turned into 7 months. And then we're like, okay, we've really missed that milestone. Like, what's going on here? And so we had people coming in on and watching, like looking in on her. Infant development, I think is what they're called, nurses and caretakers. And they started agreeing with us and saying there might be something wrong here. So I'm not sure how far reaching this is, but in BC, at least you can't assess for autism before you're 2 years old. And that's what people thought we should start with. We should start going down the trail of autism. So our team was so convinced that Madison had autism. They fudged the numbers a little bit. They knew how long a wait list there was to get assessed. And they put the paperwork in before she was 2 years old so that when she did turn 2 years old, her assessment would be pretty much a week later. And that happened. It all worked out just like planned. And so she went in. This would have been in August of 2018. Madison was assessed for autism and immediately given the diagnosis. There was the shortest appointment of my life. And I came out actually quite upset. I'm like, she got about 20 minutes of an assessment and they are slapping this sticker on her saying she's autistic, done, move on. So I was quite upset with that. And furthermore, I had this gut feeling. This is a talent or a gift or something of mine. My gut feelings, when I start to tingle inside, usually it's right. And I came out of that appointment saying, there's something still wrong. You can't just slap autism on her. There's something still wrong. And we went to our pediatrician and he wouldn't listen to me. He just said, nope, autism covers it all. It's a spectrum. It's a big umbrella. You have no idea all the different things. I said, no, there's something still wrong. So then everybody kind of jumped onto Ethan and said, you know what? We're seeing some of the similar things. And my wife and I said, no way. We are not seeing anything similar. You guys are just making stuff up, because he's extremely high functioning. He's all over the place. He is brilliant, brilliant beyond, I can't even describe how brilliant he is, way beyond his years. We weren't seeing anything with Ethan. We thought he was, no, he had hit all his milestones. We thought he was great. We had no concern for him. It was our team who was saying, well, he's not making eye contact enough, and he's not being social enough. And they always added on the enough. And that didn't sit well with us, right? Because we came back to them and said, but he is making eye contact, right? And he is being social, right? And they said, yeah, but not enough. And so we really, really hated that. But they kind of cornered us and almost forced our way into a diagnosis. And so in December, so Madison in August, Ethan in December, went in for the same assessment and came out with the same label. He was immediately assessed with autism. Within 5 months, right? We've got two kids with special needs, just like that. And talk about a blow to our reality. But we were still fighting for Madison. We were still saying, it's not right. And we actually fired our pediatrician, because he just pushed us the wrong way with his nonchalant approach and said, yeah, it's autism, don't worry about it. And we're like, don't worry about it, it's autism. No, like, you said the wrong things. Sorry, you're gone. And we found a new pediatrician, and he listened to me, and he agreed with me immediately. He said, you're right, there is something else wrong here. And he said, we're gonna get to the bottom of this. And right away I fell in love with him. I was like, oh my goodness, you are our doctor. And so he gave her the top to bottom and went very quiet. It was a long appointment. And I would say for the last 30 minutes of the appointment, he didn't say a word. And I knew what that meant. It meant he had found something, and he wasn't sure how to tell me. In the meantime, my wife is an amazing researcher. She loves spending time researching and learning. She's a lifelong learner. And she had found something that we had never heard of before called Rett syndrome. And it matched everything that Madison presented with. But it is the most horrible, horrible disease that you can ever imagine placing on your two-year-old daughter.
Can you describe what Rett syndrome is?
Rett syndrome is a spontaneous mutation of a protein within your brain on the X chromosome. So that means that it targets girls, right? Because guys don't have X chromosome. And it's spontaneous, which means the scientists out there are baffled, because it's not the mom's fault. It's not the dad's fault. It's not hereditary. It's spontaneous. It just happens. It's listed as a very rare disease in the world. Not many people have it. I don't know Canada's number, but here in BC, less than 50 have it. I think the average is about one in every 30,000 girls that are born are diagnosed with Rett. So it's very rare. Most girls will present normally for the first 16 months to 2 years. They may start walking, they may start talking, they may do everything normal, and then something snaps. So that protein breaks, or something happens in the brain, and they actually regress. And so they lose all those skills. So if they had learned how to walk, they literally lose that skill, and they no longer can walk. If they had learned how to talk, they regress and lose that ability too. There are different varieties of it. So like, there's atypical and typical, and there's variants and all that. So some girls, like, this isn't a case for everybody who has Rett. There are a few girls out there who can walk, but I would say that's like I could count them on my hand, like in the whole wide world. And there are a few girls who can talk, but again, that's like a handful, very, very rare. But Madison regressed hard, and we had just got her walking before the regression hit. She had just taken her first steps. And she has never taken a step since, quite likely never will. She never talked and never will. She barely makes a sound all day. One of the key factors or signs for Rett syndrome is that girls will constantly wring their hands and twist their hands. And Madison does that to the point where her fingers are almost crippled, if you will. So in communication, sign language is out, because she can't pull her hands apart to actually do any gestures. So then obviously like, carry on like with your own thoughts, right? She'll never toilet. She'll never feed herself. She'll never do any of those necessities of life. She is absolutely 100% dependent on a caretaker.
And the caretaker is you.
Yeah. So we do have a team. So because she was diagnosed with autism first, so here's the silver lining to that whole misdiagnosis, if you will. Because she was diagnosed with autism first, the province of BC and the country of Canada has deemed that she is qualified for services and support. Had she been diagnosed with this much more severe diagnosis of Rett syndrome, she would have fallen through the cracks. There's no support. So Madison, get this. This is gonna rock your chair here. Madison has a team of 13 doctors and therapists who are taking care of her on a daily basis. They're not all 13 come in every day. Obviously, that's way too much for anybody. But yes, 13 people who are checking her in on her on either a daily, weekly, monthly basis.
Wow.
So right now, how I'm able to do this podcast with you right now is there are literally 3 therapists in the other room with Madison right now. They're working with her on an eye gaze. That's how we're teaching her how to communicate. Is we have a state-of-the-art tablet and computer system that has cameras that look up into her eyes. They track where her eyes look on the screen. And it's a form of AAC, augmentative communication. And so they're teaching her and helping her learn how to do eye gaze. And we've got a physiotherapist who comes and works with her because we're insisting on that she keeps moving. Even if it's assisted moving, we stand her up. She's got braces and we stand her up. She's got a walker and a stander. And later today, we're going in for a wheelchair fitting. And so my life is extremely busy. This week alone, I've got 23 appointments for my kids. That's a typical life, a week in the life of Dale and his kids. So Ethan is in preschool. We have seen how he is extremely high functioning form of autism. And so we have admitted that they were correct, that there is some glitches, and the glitches are in communication and in his social aspects. Liam's in grade 1, and Liam's hasn't been assessed formally yet. We're on a very long wait list for him. So, but everybody has given the whole, he's got a severe anxiety disorder, and that has come as a result of environmental circumstances. And so, like I started by saying, he was the perfect kid. There was nothing wrong with him. But once these diagnoses started to stack up, the stress level of our house, the changes within our house, having 13 people surround Madison, it was just all too overwhelming for all of us. And so let alone a little kid, let alone a 3- and 4-year-old, and he crumbled. He's too soft-hearted. He's the most gentle, caring person in the world. And so when you throw all this chaos and stress and anxiety around him, he just took it all and couldn't process it. And it has destroyed him. And it's heartbreaking to see how a perfect little kid has changed so drastically because of environmental circumstances. The teacher keeps reporting to me that he seems to do better at school than at home, which makes sense. It plays into the whole environmental circumstances part of the equation. Is he doesn't have to deal with 13 therapists coming in and around him all the time. He doesn't have to deal with the stress and chaos of his brother Ethan throwing a fit and a temper tantrum and literally crashing into walls and tables and chairs. He doesn't have to deal with that at school. So it's almost become his safe little place. And he's doing quite well there.
So, you know, aside from your dream team, medical team that you have on board, and, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about your own support network, you know, having friends to get together with, the play dates that you get to have. What are your go-tos when things are getting to be stressful?
Music. Music comes to mind first. Back to my background, like I told you, concerts. Concerts were my life for so many years, and I wanted it to be my lifelong profession because it is the biggest passion. So I had made passion my profession. It's kind of cheesy, but whatever. I loved it. I was bragging to my friends I never worked a day in my life because I loved doing what I was doing so much. Music hasn't left my blood, for sure. The live element has, the concerts have. Even before COVID, I had to say goodbye to my business. My wife really struggled with postpartum depression after the twins were born. And so we had to make a tough decision that I would move into the stay-at-home role and she needed some distance. And so that's when we made the decision that she would go out and work and I would come home and be with the kids. So I said goodbye to my business about 3 years ago now when I became a stay-at-home dad, but music never left. And so when I'm doing chores, when I'm washing dishes, when I'm cooking, I will always have music playing, and that keeps me regulated. Once the kids are asleep and I can really zone out, like I'll put my headphones on and I'll blast it as loud as I can. And the other big thing is writing. I love to write. I should do a word count because I probably write 10 or 15,000 words a day. Like I am always writing. I'm always blogging. When I chat with friends, I'm known as the one who just goes on and on and on because I'm just typing and chatting for so long. So that's my escape. That's my self-therapy, if you will.
The blogging's great because you're really real. You know, you cover everything. You know, Yeah. You cover the struggles of being at home. You cover, you know, the good and the bad.
That's why I'm doing it. I have this catchphrase. I want to be real, raw, and vulnerable in all my writing and in who I am. Because I see, like, why not? It's kind of the, why would you be fake? Or why would you try to put on an air or mislead or think? Like, I think the other thing that got me to that point is toxic positivity. Ooh, I hate that. I hate that. How about we just be real and say that sometimes a lemon is a lemon, right? You can't always make lemonade why are we always forcing ourselves to make lemonade out of the lemons? Sometimes it's just a lemon. And let's just talk about the lemon for once.
I've heard so many therapists say that writing is such a cathartic way of trying to get a better night's sleep. You know, if you get your thoughts down on paper or in a book or, you know, whatever, and it doesn't even need to be long, just whatever, it could be a to-do list even, chances are that your quality of sleep is going to be better. So what kind of a sleeper are you? I know you don't get a lot of sleep.
Yeah, that's an understatement. Oh, wow. I average about between 3 and 4 hours of sleep a night. It's part of special needs for a very, very long time. Madison, we just couldn't get her to sleep properly. Ethan had issues too. The other component is that there's just so much to do in my day. And so it often takes into the wee hours of the morning to get all my chores done and everything. So yeah, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but my bedtime is usually 2 a.m. and I'm up at 7 a.m.
And it's not uncommon. I think I read somewhere. So you've got your 2 a.m. Go to bedtime, but then, you know, you and your wife are sometimes having dinner at 11 o'clock at night.
So yeah, we've tried other things and the team around us has tried to make life easier for us and they've encouraged us, but you know what? We just can't make it work. Our kids all demand different meals for different reasons. So I'm in the kitchen just up to my eyebrows, just cooking and making all kinds of different things. So to throw on our dinner as well, unless we're okay eating chicken nuggets and spaghetti every single night, usually what happens is I will wait until the kids are in bed and then I'll go back into the kitchen to make ourselves a proper dinner, something that we can actually enjoy and eat hot. See, that's the other thing, is you have to compromise somewhere. So I think there's a lot of parents out there probably listening to me right now and saying, whoa, you are ridiculous for eating dinner so late in the night. So I would challenge them and say, well, is your dinner hot when you eat it at 4 or 5 o'clock? Because I have a lot of friends, I have a lot of parent friends who force themselves to eat with their kids, but they've been interrupted so many times that by the time they get to their dinner, it's cold, right? There's that meme that goes around around the internet, Facebook, right? How many times have you warmed up your coffee in the microwave, right? It's true. That's true. So my wife and I kind of demand a bit higher quality for ourselves when it comes to our dinner, even if it means eating a bit later. So yes, we eat dinner very late, but it is always high quality and hot when we eat dinner. So that's the trade we've made.
Well, and I would also argue that, you know, given the fact that you guys don't, I'm assuming, get a lot of date nights, that, you know, every night, if it's happening that late at night and you're having a really nice, just the two of you, hot dinner, that could be considered your little date. That's your time together.
Yeah. We always eat together and there's always the big sigh. Like we each have it. It's a, okay, so kids are in bed. Maybe the chores aren't all done, but who cares? That's a part of resiliency right there, right? Like you don't have to always get everything done, right? That's a little tip for people who are struggling with being resilient, is your kitchen doesn't always have to be perfect. And so sometimes we're just like, you know what? We made it through another day, and it doesn't really matter what the kitchen looks like right now. We made it through the day. Like you said, we're having a gourmet hot dinner right now with each other, and we take that big sigh and we just block out life for an hour. And yeah, and it feels good.
You have posted that you're living with MS as well. So on top of having the challenges you have with the kids, you're also living with MS. How does that play into everything? And you don't touch on that a lot. And we haven't even mentioned it up until now in this interview. Is that a deliberate thing for you?
Yes. So just to remind you and everybody, August 2018, Madison got autism. December 2018, Ethan got autism. January 2019, a month later, Madison gets Rett. And February of 2019 is when I was diagnosed with MS. That bundle of diagnoses right there rocked our family so bad that we barely survived, to be bluntly honest with you. As resilient as I think I am, and as many of the secrets that I know about resiliency, that almost broke me. It was too much. And let's just be honest, you can't put a silver lining on that. It was horrible. And my wife took it even rougher than I did, even more extreme than I did. She was already battling with some lingering postpartum depression that had gone untreated. She kind of self-treated by doing the swap with me and said, you know what, if I go back to work and you come stay home with the kids, that's going to help me. But it was never really professionally treated. And so it lingered. And then all the diagnoses hit and she crumbled. So she had to take a leave of absence from work that lasted a year. She did seek out some professional help and spent a lot of time sleeping, spent a lot of time in solitude, away from the noise, away from the stress. She just couldn't handle seeing all of it. Every time, we have a very small house. And so every time you come into the room and you do a scan for her, she would be seeing four very sick people, right? Mm-hmm. She would be seeing all three of her kids in different stages of distress or sickness or diagnosis. And then she'd look over at me, and even though MS is an invisible disease, she still knew it was there. And she's seeing the effects of it. Back to the question, I haven't forgot your question again, is it deliberate that I ignore it? That's just who I am. I was seeing the situation as I've got three very sick kids, all with diagnosis. And now I've got a wife who's still struggling from postpartum, and now this new addition of mental health struggles. I'm the strongest one here. So I've got to take care of everybody. And so I've got to stuff it. I've got to suck it up, if you will, and just be stronger. I made some resolves for myself. Like I resolved to start going to the gym. I have never gone to the gym in my life before. I am not that type of person at all. But when I was given this diagnosis, and then I did some research on my own, and I saw that MS attacks your muscles, kind of destroys that part of your body. I'm a very fit, athletic person to begin with. And so I did not like that diagnosis at all. And then I started feeling it. And I don't know if this was like mind over matter, because I was told it was going to happen, then I started feeling it. I think I'm stronger than that. So I think I actually did start feeling it, and it wasn't just my mind telling me I did. But when I was interacting with Madison, remember, she's completely immobile. So I have to lift her everywhere and carry her everywhere. And I started feeling it in my knees and my legs. I was like, oh boy, I got to go take care of myself here. I got to strengthen my legs and knees and all that. So in some ways, I'm not hiding it. In some ways, I'm not disguising it. But for the most part, it takes the back burner, because in my life, my kids are more important. And I put them first.
We've talked a lot about challenges. Why don't we talk about the rewards in your life? What are the rewards with having kids with special needs and living with MS? Can you see any silver lining in any of that?
We have three amazing kids. Like, they have great qualities to them, as I would assume every kid does. You find the best in them. You find those qualities. I wouldn't say that's a silver lining to them having their special needs, though. The fact that they have special needs has been extremely depressing for us, and it's been a kick in the gut. And finding positive things that have come from that, we've developed new friends. We've found new friends because we have the commonality. I would say that would be the biggest thing.
And the friends have come through what? Through special needs support groups or online?
A lot online, especially with the Rett community, because it is so small and so scattered. We have we've met people through online because, well, here in Kelowna, for example, there's only two girls in Kelowna that have Rett. And one of the girls is 22 or 23 years old. So drastically different than Madison, totally different stage of life. We actually have met that family. They invited us over for lunch as soon as they heard about us, because that's how desperate we all are for like that common ground. Like, you have a Rett girl, you have a Rett daughter. That's amazing. Let's talk, because we have a huge thing in common. That being said, there's only two of us. And I said earlier, in all of BC, there's only 45 or 46. So you need the online community. So for me, it's through Instagram. I have a fairly strong Instagram account that has found a lot of friends all over the world, some who I deem to be very close friends that we talk regularly and relate on issues and things like that.
What would be a takeaway message that you would have for somebody who's struggling right now?
I think I would go on to one of the phrases that was incorrectly told to me. And everybody told me that things were going to get easier. This was a catchphrase that I was given a lot, and still am to this day. It never sat well with me. Every time somebody said things are going to get easier, something triggered inside me and I felt a little twinge and was like, I don't think it is. I don't think things are going to get easier. Now that's extremely depressing, right? To think that. So I couldn't just stop there, right? So back to my whole typing late at night, blogging, trying to figure things out, venting. It dawned on me, I'm almost like, I have to continue. I have to get up again tomorrow and things aren't going to get easier tomorrow. I have to get up again the next day and things aren't going to get easier. Again, in my opinion, things aren't going to get easier. So how do I make it through life? And I realized that every day that I was going through my struggles and taking care of Ethan and Madison and Liam, even taking care of my wife and getting her through her battles. Every day that I was cooking dinner again, every day that I was making sure the laundry was done, I was getting a little bit stronger. And then I'd wake up again the next morning, do it all over again, and a little bit stronger. And I felt this because I was getting more maybe proficient, or things started to come easier to me. And that's where I realized, I was like, wait a minute, a few months ago, it was a real struggle for me to do this. And now it's not. But the circumstances haven't changed. Things haven't gotten any easier. It's just not as much of a struggle anymore. And then it dawned on me, things don't get easier. You get stronger. By not giving up, you are moving forward. You are getting stronger. And so the worst thing in life is to give up with anything. I think that's a universal on anything. Like giving up a game when you're playing a game, that's seen as poor sportsmanship. Like, don't do that. Just finish. Even if you're going to lose, finish the game and learn something from it, right? When you're cooking, don't give up, right? You can always fix it. You can always turn it into something better. Don't give up. By not giving up, you are learning. You are getting stronger. You are becoming more resilient. And that is overshadowing the fact that things aren't getting easier. And so that's my personal belief. I will argue all day long that things don't get easier in my life. But I have found ways, because I'm getting stronger every day, to make it to the end of my day. You will become stronger, and that's how you get through.
You've probably heard the expression that's been touted a lot since the pandemic started. It's okay not to be okay. Dale has reminded us of the importance of saying and believing it. His speaking engagements, blog, and writing tell the honest truth of what his daily life is like. And it's helping him to stay buoyant in the turbulent times of his daily life. In one of his blog posts, Dale says, "We need to ensure we're being kind to ourselves and not holding ourselves to the expectation of being that perfect parent." And he says, "Sometimes you just have to be okay with being the good enough parent." It's not just his honest perspective that's notable, but how he manages to keep going, knowing that things could get harder. Daily exercise, music, even if it is blasting in his ears, and late night dinners with his wife once the kids are asleep. These are all positive and joy-filled things that he does every day to regroup and recenter himself. Dale Allen Berg is one of my resilient people. Check out Dale's website, daleallenberg.com, and follow him on Instagram at daleallenberg. I'd like to thank Dale for joining me, and I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of Resilient People. Today's episode was produced by Edit Audio, with thanks to Abby Gibson, Steph Coburn, and Sophie Shin. To learn more about me and other resilient people, visit resilientpeople.ca and on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss future episodes. And don't forget to write a review wherever you listen. Even a simple click for 5 stars is good for me. I'd like to know how you stay resilient. Feel free to share with me your thoughts and what keeps you in a positive mindset. And I'm always on the hunt for resilient people to talk with. If you or someone you know is considered to be resilient, please get in touch with me. Send me an email, info@resilientpeople.ca, or contact me through the website. Once again, it's resilientpeople.ca. Maybe you'll be a guest on an upcoming episode. Till next time, I'm Janet Fanacki. Bye for now.
Divorce sucks, but it doesn't have to be all bad. Hi, I'm Leanne Townsend, a family law lawyer and partner at the law firm Brody Thorning LLP. I'm also the host of the Divorcing Well podcast. Divorcing Well aims to help provide listeners with the tools and knowledge they need to support themselves legally, financially, mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. I want listeners to tune into Divorcing Well because they are looking for the knowledge and inspiration to get them through the rough days. And on the positive days, they will gain the tools that they need to heal and move through the various stages of grief that divorce can bring. Each week, I interview an expert or a guest who's been out there in the trenches going through divorce themselves, sharing their stories, their knowledge, their inspiration with listeners, so that ultimately I can help them to divorce well. You can find my podcast on all podcast platforms or visit my website at www.leannetownsend.ca.